This is Judaism Unbound, episode 39, The Pico Union Project. We wanted to open with a brief note to our listeners about the presidential election and an election to a number of other offices nationally and locally just concluded a few days ago. We generally record our episodes a few weeks in advance, and it takes us a while to edit them, and so we aren't necessarily able immediately to be the most timely, although we hope that our episodes are generally timely. We actually think this episode today is an interesting one in terms of the timeliness of some of the ideas that are in the air, because our interview with the Pico Union Project emphasizes an idea that's core to their mission of loving your neighbor as yourself. And while we may have more to say about where America is going in the years ahead, we definitely think that it's a worthwhile place to start, that loving your neighbor as yourself is a primary Jewish value, and that the idea of a space in which Jews and non-Jews can be together and explore what it means to live together in society, which is what happens at the Pico Union Project, is an especially heartening thing to be thinking about in these days. And so we hope you'll really enjoy this episode, and we hope that our community will continue to think together in the weeks, months, and years ahead. So without further ado, let's get into this week's episode.
Welcome back, everyone. I'm Dan Liebenson.
And I'm Lex Rofus.
And we're here today in the third of our four-episode series that we're calling Jewish and Non-Jewish Sensibilities, looking at an organization in Los Angeles that really is trying to, in many ways, fuse Jewish and non-Jewish sensibilities. It's called the Pico Union Project, and it is an organization housed in the original home of Sinai Temple, one of the largest and most well-known synagogues in Los Angeles. It bills itself as a multi-faith cultural arts center and house of worship that aims to help invigorate the community of Los Angeles and reflect the Jewish value of being a light to all nations. It talks specifically about being dedicated to the principle of loving your neighbor as yourself, elevating this teaching into a practice in their historic building by bringing diverse cultures together through song, story, art, food, and prayer. We're really excited to find out more about the Pico Union Project today and ideas that stem from it and flow out of it and into it. We're here today with the leadership team of the Pico Union Project, three people: Craig Taubman, who is a illustrious Jewish musician and also an illustrious musician in the, let's say, extra-Jewish world. He has written a lot of music for Disney. We also are joined by Dr. Zach Lasker, who is the new executive director of the Pico Union Project. Previously, he was the camp director at Camp Ramah, California, and also the director of the Melton Research and Education Projects at the Davidson School of the Jewish Theological Seminary. In addition to that, Zach is very interested in yoga and has been doing and studying yoga instruction as well. And our final guest today is Jason Chu. He is an LA-based hip-hop and spoken word artist. Jason is a Christian who works at the Pico Union Project as the chief storyteller. So we're super excited to have the three of you here today. Welcome to Judaism Unbound.
We're thrilled to be here and grateful that Judaism Unbound and that you invited us to spend the afternoon with you.
So I guess a good place to start would be just if, Craig, perhaps you could describe to us a little bit of what Pico Union Project is and how it came about.
With pleasure. I think it came about at least 100 plus years ago, before I was born, when this building that we're sitting in today was built originally by Russian immigrants who were striving for the American dream. And they were Orthodox in name, but not in practice. And they created the first liberal congregation here, Sinai Temple, which was the first conservative congregation on the West Coast. And their values were really about community and very, very American values, you know, life, liberty, the pursuit of justice, not as much about faith. And I think that's a reflection of our community now as well, the current community. I grew up in the conservative movement. I was bar mitzvahed at Sinai Temple after it moved from this location to two other locations. I was married at Sinai Temple 31 years ago. I started with Rabbi David Wolpe 20 years ago, a service primarily for younger people called Friday Night Live that was very, very popular, would attract upwards of 2,000 people. And I was super Jew on the weekends. And in the middle of the week, I was writing music for Disney, so reaching very, very large secular markets. And I noticed the following. Every time we invited the other into our space at Sinai Temple for services, it was always better. It was always stronger. It was always more interesting. And they showed us things that we were so in the middle of it. I realized that I was simply better. I was simply more full when I wasn't just with Jewish people from the West Side. And about 3 years ago, I was approached by the head of the Jewish Historic Society. His name is Steve Sass, and I grew up with him. And he said, they're selling the church. I said, great. He said, no, but it's not just the church. It's the first home of Sinai Temple. You got to go see it. I said, well, I'm going to buy a church. What am I going to buy a church for? But I did go and see it. And I walked in. I got goosebumps. And there was just something that happened. I said, I'm going to buy a church. And I didn't know how I was going to pay for it. And it happened. It just was an amazing thing. It happened. I was at the right place at the right time. And I thought I was going to create a very cool club, you know, a destination place with a bar and just great music, because I'm a musician. I sometimes express myself in faith environments. I love multi-faith things, but I'm a musician. And I asked my daughter what she thought, and she was in school at Pitzer College and in a school of community change and organization. She said, Daddy, that's a stupid question. What does the community want? What does the community need? And I listened to her and I asked the community, and it became evident the community needed housing. Well, I couldn't provide housing. They needed a place to meet. I could do that. And then I was started to be approached by different churches, and three churches, a Latino church, an African-American church, a Korean church, then the Women's Mosque of America, and then a Jewish faith community approached me and said, let's do it. So within 6 months, I think actually it was more, within a year, there were five faith communities meeting here. But our primary focus was rooted in our mission, which was Ve'ahavta l'recha kamocha, love your neighbor. And it's preached at pretty much every mosque, every temple, every synagogue, every church, pretty much every Sabbath, every Shabbat, every Juma. And yet it's a bunch of talk. You can't love your neighbor if you don't know your neighbor. So we dedicated to creating a space where people could get to know their neighbor. Not kumbaya. It wasn't that we're going to have interfaith services where, you know, we would take a little bit from here, a little bit from there. There are five independent faith groups. What we would do rather is just create an environment where people could meet. Food was important. Art was important. Conversation. We do Project of the Innocents here with Loyola Law School, which is right up the street, and they meet here. We do programs in food sustenance. We meet the people where the people are at. And we're really, really, really good at it, and we're really, really, really bad at it. And we're really committed to being a place where people can get to know their neighbor. Here is, I think, a key point that is not part of our mission statement, and maybe at some point will be, but it's really hard to love your neighbor if you don't know your neighbor. And either one of them will not happen unless you know and love yourself. And I think right now in the Jewish community, and in most communities, people don't really know who they are. They know who they're supposed to be, or how they're supposed to fit in, how they're supposed to operate, whether at work, at play, in their church, in their whatever, but they don't really know who they are. And we're just a place that says, if you're willing to explore who you are, then in all likelihood, you'll get to meet other people who are in a similar situation.
So, Jason, one of the things that really struck me when we talked a few months ago was just how inspired and moved you were by being involved with this organization that in some way at least puts itself out as a Jewish grounded space. And I would just be curious to hear you reflect about your experience and tell us a little bit about what it has been exactly, but also, you know, how you see yourself as a non-Jew and others interacting with this and where you think this might go.
I would start off by saying how central the arts are to this space. There's other organizations, faith-based and secular, doing great work in communities, bring people together. But I'll say that the arts bring a life to intercultural, interfaith, multi-generational stuff, that if you don't have music, if you don't have story, if you don't have people in a space that understand how to tell their story in a way that broadcasts out. I've been thinking recently with some friends about the idea of soul, right? Soul music. Or when people say, oh, that actor, that poet, they're so soulful. What does that mean, right? What does it mean to be soulful? And my friend and I sort of came up with this rubric where to be soulful is to be opposite of empathic. To be empathic means I can feel you. To be soulful means I can communicate in a way that you feel me. And I think that that's something that's missing from a lot of things. Well, you know, so I'm a Gentile, you know, I'm a Christian, sort of a progressive Christian. And one thing that I see in the Christian world is this lack of intergenerational work. You know, there's a lot of young millennial people of all cultures, of all faiths, who practice religion. We practice spirituality. But for some reason, especially in 2016, the ways we talk about ourselves, the way we see our world, are so different than the ways that even our parents did. And there's this disconnect. And what I think brings it in together, you know, I mean, just a couple weeks ago, we had Peter Yarrow. Right? Am I saying that right? Yeah, Peter Yarrow, right? Of Peter, Paul, and Mary was on stage here. And there were easily 3-4 generations of artists on stage sharing. And what was amazing to me is that great art, you know, you've got this guy for decades, you know, before I was born, he was platinum selling. But because he has soul, I could feel his journey and story. And when do I ever get to sit down with somebody in their 60s, 70s, 80s and feel from their soul? And so for me, like I said, I'm a Chinese American Gentile. I moved to LA a few years ago to do this music thing. And what drew me into this space was the soulfulness. So I came for High Holidays last year. And I was sitting there. So I did a piece about immigration, this spoken word poem. But I was just sitting there through the rest of the service, literally being moved to tears. Yes, it's a beautiful place, the stained glass, the ambiance, all that. But more than that, what really struck me is that, and you know, Pico Union, the heart and soul of it is Craig and his connections and his vision. And what struck me was how all these different people, musicians, folks from the community, he was bringing them up on stage, and more so than playing a guitar, he was, and I want to say this in the most positive way possible, he was playing the audience, not manipulating the audience, but knowing how to read the audience and saying, right now, we need this woman who suffered a great loss. We need you to come up. And I think that to me is what is so central to this space. That's what keeps me coming back over and over again, is religion that is based on an outmoded power dynamic is dead. Religion is not priest down to the people. Religion is not just, you know, it's not a ladder. It's not a vertical ladder. Religion is dialogue. It's 2016. We all expect to have a voice, right? If we don't have a voice somewhere, we leave. Why go to a church, a synagogue, a mosque where your input doesn't matter when you can sit on Facebook and put out a comment and 20 people will respond, right? We are all empowered now. We don't need, some do, but we don't necessarily need to go to a church or a synagogue or a worship place to feel heard. We can feel heard anywhere. We go to connect. We go to bridge and to see that feedback loop. And that to me is what Pico Union does really well. It's this feedback loop between audience and performer and worship leader and rabbi. And there's dialogue, there's discourse.
Let me ask you something. I mean, I feel like in what you were talking about, Jason, I heard two different things, which I think are both different and related, but I want to tease them out separately. The first was what you were calling sort of soulfulness. And I think that's fundamentally an artist's capacity, right, to move others. Not that it's only artists, but I'm just saying that the idea that artists have a special power, special ability to do what you described, to move others.
With I think the important corollary being that everyone is an artist in some way, right? Our artistry may take different forms, but we are all, you know, for some of us, being a parent is our form of creation and response. Absolutely, it's artistic.
Well, so and in a way, and that was the other thing that you said, was that fundamentally an important thing was to empower everybody, have everybody feel like they have a voice. You know, in the era of Facebook, people are competing with other forums where they clearly have a voice. And so how can we characterize religion as a part of life where you just have to sit quietly and your voice is not part of that? But I want to start with the artist's question, because I think that it's one that we're particularly interested in at this point in the podcast. And I'm especially curious about the confidence. I felt like I heard you and Craig speaking in a confident voice that sounds to me like an artist, right? Who says, you know, I know that I have this power, this ability to move people. And it feels to me like a lot of the talk in the Jewish world today is not a confident talk, right? It's a talk of being afraid that we don't have the capacity to move people and that this stuff isn't working. And I'm really curious about, in particular, if you could reflect on the fact that the PICO Union Project is driven by artists, and to what extent do you see that power in particular in the PICO Union Project? And to what extent, especially you, Craig, I mean, do you think that what there is in the PICO Union Project can really be translated much more broadly across the Jewish world? How would that happen? Should we be putting artists in charge of Jewish religious life and organizational life in a much more profound way than we currently do? Is there a way, like you were saying earlier, Jason, to really cultivate the artistry, the ability of every person to be an artist, and so somehow we need to cultivate that mentality among Jewish leadership? I don't know, but I feel like there's something important here in terms of the role of artists and the way that artists think and the way that artists act and what artists believe in terms of being able to do something like this.
The artists were at the helm of Jewish life. If you look back at Psalms, if you look back at Shir Hamalot B'Shuv Adonai, sing a song of praise, song is on high. And there was dancing, there was incense, there were Kohanim, there were, you know, holy men, and there were dancing women, and they walked upstairs, and it was wonderful. I mean, my recollection was a long time ago, but it was wonderful. And then, you know, the temple's destroyed, and we suddenly, instead of a people of storytelling, you know, if you look at like the Maariv service, the evening service, there's a part right in the middle, right before Maariv Aravim, where it's essentially Maariv Aravim, where we're obliged to create our own story of when day becomes night and night becomes day and da-da-da, this will... It was art. And then temple's destroyed, no more art, not even no more art, but you are not allowed to play an instrument on the Chagim, on the holidays, or on the Sabbath. Well, that's a good one. And we become a people of the book, which is also good if you're telling the stories, like the Bible. It's like, they're amazing stories. There are laws in there, but it's not about the laws. It's about telling your story. And then suddenly it became about the law. And it became about intellectualism and knowledge. That's my critique. It's rich, though. It's 2,000 years of rabbinic richness. I would not let go of it. I would just partner with the best rabbis and put them in touch with the best artists and put them in touch with the people with the most money and put them in touch with the activists who want to go out into the larger community and change things.
There's this Korean-American theologian. I think he's based in Chicago. His name is Sung-Chan Ra. And he has this book. It's called The New Evangelicalism. And he posits, right? So, again, the Christian church is dying out, right? People, young millennials are fleeing. But he posits that Christianity isn't dying out. It's changing, yeah. Right? It's that for every, you know, 60, 70, 80-year-old Caucasian congregation that shuts down, there's a young Latino church. There's a young Taiwanese American, Korean American, Middle Eastern church that's opening its doors. And this is the funny thing about religion, right? We religion belongs to those who need it. And when religion goes from being something we need to something we do because it's how we stay in power, it dies out. He says legacy congregations need to understand that their legacy is going to be built not by making another generation of what they've done, but by investing their resources in the next generation of what's coming. And that's exactly it. These legacy congregations have all the, these funds and resources. But the question is, do we invest that in trying to keep the wheel spinning? Or do we acknowledge that there's new things coming up that, you know, investing there returns a hundredfold ROI, return on our investment, versus, you know, trying to keep another generation going? And then there's this other thing. I forget who it is that says this, but there's this this black female artist. She says, for women, poetry is not a luxury. And what she means by that is for those who have gone through trauma or those who've experienced marginalization, art is not what we do for leisure. It's what we do for sustenance. And I think the same—
To fill our soul.
To fill our soul, to become soulful, to be nurtured. And I think that that is when religion shines. Religion shines when people who need hope, when people who need community, when people who need infrastructure find it. And for those of us who have hope, we have resources, we have community, we have infrastructure, how do we participate in that, right? We can. I see this in the Christian church. There's this rise of triumphalism, this sort of conquesting, like, yes, we get it. You know, God is good and God has brought the victory. And then, you know, you get demagogues. You get people who need to continually further this narrative of struggle, even though they're wealthy, even though they're mainstream and entrenched. They keep finding new boogeymen to chase after, because the truth is, when you realize you're empowered, what do? You have to start giving back, because if you don't start, you either have to fight an enemy or start giving back, because if you don't, you stagnate.
Or make up an enemy.
Exactly. So by fighting an enemy, it could be a completely made-up enemy. You could be—
We do that a lot in the Jewish community.
We do that a lot in the Christian community.
You know, we create these enemies. They're coming to get us. Well, they come, what are they don't—
Right. In the Christian community, they talk about, you know, the conservative religion everywhere. It's like, oh, you know, gays, you know, a war on values, a war on family. That no gay person is saying, hey, you can't be Christian. You know, but we're chasing after it because we're not willing to fight these other battles.
So we've talked a lot about we've talked about buildings a decent amount. We've made some allusions to all sorts of Jewish texts, actually. But I was, as a result, thinking of sort of our first collective Jewish construction project, which was the tabernacle. And for people who read their way through the Torah, I'll speak for myself. I get to the tail end of Exodus after the juicy stuff. After the Ten Commandments, and it's like super. We're going to talk for 17 chapters. I don't know how many chapters. We're going to talk for a bunch of chapters about building materials and various, you know, mechanisms of getting funding. Like, it's not what we think of as exciting. But there's one piece of it that I learned within the last few years that really opened up the story for me, and it's there's a story behind this tabernacle. There were two people chosen to lead this project.
And many of you listening might recognize this story because I've mentioned it before, but coming at it from a different angle this time,
their names were Bezalel and Aholiab. And what it says about them is not so much, but there's all sorts of midrash. And the midrash commentary on these texts, which fills in some of the gaps, says Bezalel was 13 years old. So that sort of blows your mind. 13-year-old was put in charge of the biggest and first construction project of the Jewish people.
With Legos.
Right. And second, Oholiab was, I forget the exact age, but he was an old man, maybe 70, maybe 80. And he was from the tribe of Dan, one of the least important tribes. And a descendant of not Leah or Rachel, but actually one of the maidservants. So not typically somebody who gets prestigious, somebody whose tribe gets prestigious honors like this in terms of building the tabernacle. And I thought that was the most beautiful thing, that we've got, you know, a youngin who's 13 and an old man teaming up intergenerationally. And also this bottom up element where it wasn't Moses, it wasn't Aaron, it wasn't Miriam, it wasn't Korach, it wasn't any of these guys that we hear about at sort of the front of the Jewish community who led this. It was the artists. That's what these guys seem to be. And so I'm curious, as I think about that, I'd just love to hear more on what you've alluded to a little in terms of the bottom-up nature of PICO Union that you try to hone, and also just sort of the ways that different constituencies involved in your work. If there are examples of how, you know, the tribes of Dan of your community who are otherwise overlooked have been empowered by what PICO Union tries to do.
Well, one very cool observations. I had no idea his name was Bezalel. I thought his name was Boswell. I mean, who knew? We tried to empower what we call first followers, not leaders. There's too much, and this is not my idea. I saw it from the guy who created CD Baby. I'm blanking on his name right now. We put so much emphasis on leadership. And everybody, again, thinks that if you're a leader, you just have to create. We put more focus on creating followers, creating low-hanging fruit that more people can join in. You cannot be a leader without a first follower. You can wax poetic all you want. Just because you wax poetic and doesn't mean, you know, you're doing anything significant. Doesn't mean you're doing anything insignificant either. But without followers and first followers, people who are willing to say, you know, I didn't come up with that idea, but that's pretty cool, and I'm going to jump in even if I look foolish. And then you have mob psychology where other people join in. And then you kind of, you know, you get to the point where you say, man, if I don't join in really soon, I'll miss the boat completely. It wasn't Moses. They're the Jewish... The Jewish example would be, it's not Moses, it was Nachshon. Moses was supposed to cross the sea, but it took some guy, Nachshon, to actually jump in. It took the first follower. He should get a hell of a lot more credit than Moses. And Miriam should get a lot more credit. We try to nurture people, anybody, to come in and do. Not just lead, though, do.
One overarching theme that we've been discussing relates to what you said before, Jason, about sort of Christianity versus the success of churches. As you said, it doesn't necessarily mean that Christianity is dying if individual churches are dying. It might just be that Christianity is changing. And we've been talking about the same thing in Judaism. A lot of Jewish institutions, whether it's synagogues, federations, all kinds, name your acronym, are struggling. And maybe not from our podcast guests, but often in the Jewish community, that the death of Jewish institutions is equated with the loss of Judaism. And so I guess I'm curious if Jason, you could expand on what you were alluding to there.
Yeah. I mean, I think to me, it's very important to not keep the ship going just because we have a ship. You know what I'm saying? It's very important that religion is created for the people, right? We don't bring the people into the building in order to keep the religion going, right? And you know, I don't know about Torah. I know in at least Christian scripture, there's this saying that man is not created for the Sabbath, but Sabbath is created for man. And to me, what that means is, you know, these things, these institutions are created because we need to connect to God, to others, to ourselves. And when the institution stops facilitating that, then what happens is basically, I feel like things die when they need to die. And if, you know, if we see something dying off, often my first instinct is to protect it, to huddle, to circle the wagons. But I think we need to ask certain questions like, are we so focused on keeping this one thing clinging to life support that we don't see the five other things that are springing up and begging for resources or time or investment or you know, a stage?
So, Zach, we've heard a little bit from your colleagues, your new colleagues at the PICO Union Project about
what they've been up to and how Pico Union was founded. But I'd love to hear from you as the new executive director, both a little bit about your history and your recent work with within the world of conservative Judaism, and also what brought you to Pico Union and what you're looking forward to.
I appreciate that question. So to start very briefly at the beginning, I am a product of the Los Angeles conservative Jewish community. When I was growing up, it was in a time where my parents just checked the little box that said conservative Judaism, and they threw themselves into all of the glory of what that might mean in the Los Angeles area, which meant that my sister and I went to Jewish day school. We went to a conservative supplementary high school. We were involved with youth group. We went to Jewish summer camp. My parents were very active at our conservative synagogue. And all of those experiences and organizations were a blessing and really continue to be a blessing for my family. And just embedded in us a commitment to Jewish practice, to Jewish life, to Jewish community. And it was amazing. And when I decided to become a Jewish professional and specifically to focus in on the world of education, nothing appealed to me more than the opportunity to give back, especially in an environment such as Jewish summer camp, where Judaism is not just learned, but it really is lived. Not to mention the appeal of working with young kids, and much more importantly as a camp director, working with young and emerging adults on their Jewish journey, and really solidifying what Judaism means to me, to them. So that my childhood and the first chapter of my professional career were just incredible. And when the position at JTS became available to work in the Graduate School of Education, it coincided with a point in my own trajectory where I started to get an itch, a curiosity as to what was happening outside of Jewish camp and what was happening outside of the conservative movement, both with the people among the children and families who were most engaged, and also with those children and families who we weren't even engaging, either because sleepaway camp just wasn't for them, which it's for most kids, I believe, but it's certainly not for every child, or because they were just doing other things. And working at the Jewish Theological Seminary in the Graduate School of Education really gave me an opportunity to take that step back and to look at the ecosystem of Jewish education from a broader distance, and to understand all of the different possible settings of education and the different steps towards innovation that were occurring in each one of those, what the professionals needed in order for them to feel nourished and inspired so that they could get back and provide experiences for their learners. And so to your question, in my time at the seminary, I feel like I've learned a lot about how people are defining themselves, about the shifting trends, as I mentioned earlier, just in sociology, this shift away from broad definitions of Judaism and Jewish life to something that I think is much more authentic, and people searching for experiences that are, I think, that are smaller, more meaningful, much more focused, that speak to who they are in terms of their interests and abilities, like music or art or something more intellectual and text-oriented, but also that really account for the reality that our families and our adults are just shifting in terms of their identities and their affiliations. The look of the American Jewish family is wonderfully colorful and diverse and much more different than it was 10, 20 years ago. And so what excites me about the Pico Union Project, and not just the Pico Union Project, but there are other wonderful examples of emerging organizations that are, I think, are at the forefront of Jewish life, is exactly as Craig and Jason have shared, this idea of creating space for people to come in, to ask questions, to get to know themselves, and to get to know other people and what is similar between them and other people, and what's different about them and other people, and what Judaism has to say about it all.
And I just want to clarify, I think I heard Craig say this a while ago, but I just love the way that you keep going back to the framing of love your neighbor as yourself as the core idea. And you keep saying you have to know your neighbor. And I think Craig said also earlier, and this sounds very right to me, that you also have to know yourself, right? That so really you have to move forward on these two fronts, which is one, getting to know your neighbor and learning from your neighbor, and the other being that you need to deeply, I would say, understand and know yourself and also probably love yourself. And I actually thought that that's also interesting in that what we've been exploring a lot and what Lex talked to, just mentioned to Craig, was this idea that essentially Jewish values, if your commitment is to Jewish values as opposed to, you know, the Jewish people or the Jewish religion or whatever, you know, other people might phrase it as, you know, then clearly, right, one of the things that's going on here is that Jewish values are permeating into the lives of non-Jews like Jason and like I think probably many people who encounter the project. And on the flip side, I feel like you've actually been one of the leading thinkers about the way in which values of other peoples might be something that Jews could absorb into their lives in ways that don't cause the kinds of conflicts or ideas that sometimes people say, you know, we shouldn't be absorbing values from other peoples and other religions or other societies. And so I'm also curious to hear you, you know, add that part into your reflection.
So over the past about 5 years, I've spent a significant amount of time exploring the practice of yoga. And I first came into the practice of yoga simply to learn how to stretch my body and for a physical release of sorts. And I stuck with it because I found what I was looking for when I first walked in the door. But I also began to value the deeper levels of yoga, which are really centered on mindful behavior, on breathing, on creating space, on being self-reflective, and trying to find stability, both on and off the mat. And a couple of years into my practice, I was in Cleveland, Ohio, teaching a course on experiential Jewish education to a group of educators, and was feeling a little stiff and decided to go and explore a yoga studio that was a couple blocks away. And I was really anxious when I walked into that studio because it wasn't a studio that I was familiar with. I didn't know the instructors, and I didn't know what I was going to find. And I am a little bit self-conscious in terms of physical movement. And lo and behold, within 30 seconds, I felt at home. I felt like I was recognized. I felt honored. And I felt comfortable with the sequence that was presented to the people in the class. And I had this moment of just thinking, wow, this is precisely what I want for Jews and the learners with whom I work. I want them to be motivated to go out wherever they are to find space, communal space, in which they can engage and to participate in this in the practice of Judaism. And I want them to feel recognized. I want them to feel honored. I want them to feel included. What is it about how yoga is taught and practiced that can inform how we teach about and steward Jewish communal life? That, to me, was a really important driving question. So I spent the past couple of years researching just that and trying to understand beyond what has become wildly popular in North America as a physical practice, what are the layers that really lie beneath the practice of yoga that can inform Jewish life? And to me, there's absolutely no conflict. If I can draw a principle, a skill, a technique that can enhance my Jewish experience, then I'm better off than when I started, to answer part of your question. And lo and behold, I think that there is an incredible toolkit in exactly as I just explained, in mindful behavior, in intentionality, what we as Jews call kavanah, in finding stability, and in really understanding what Judaism is all about. And what I mean by that is that I think that when most people start a practice like yoga, they might be under the impression that yoga is about physical alignment. It's about coming into the pose, into downward facing dog or a triangle pose or a headstand in perfect alignment. And that's not at all what it's about. It really doesn't matter what your downward facing dog is like on any given day and what you look like. What matters is how you're thinking about it. What matters is that you are breathing through the experience. And what matters is that you're being self-reflective and thinking, what am I learning about myself? And this is what begins to, I think, address the question that you brought up. How is a place like PICO Union encouraging the importance of people learning about themselves so that they can understand their neighbor and ultimately love their neighbor? Through the practice of yoga, there's an extraordinary amount that you can uncover about yourself and how you face conflict, how you face tension, how you work to be stable, and ultimately to find ease and to elongate, to grow. And to me, that is immediately transferable into Jewish practice because and this might be a little irreverent, but to me, the point of Jewish ritual and practice is less about making sure that all my knives and spoons and forks are separated appropriately so that there's milk and dairy. And it's less about making sure that I bend my knees and I bow a certain number of times when I'm in a tefillah or a prayer experience. And it's much more about these higher ideas of being intentional about how we treat the world, about how we relate to people around us, and how we form a relationship with God. And I think that all of our Jewish ritual and essentially the mitzvot are all vehicles towards self-exploration so that we can learn about ourselves and we can learn how to be the best friend, husband, wife, son, daughter, sister, brother that we can be towards the people around us. So to give you one specific example, there's an idea called svadhyaya in yoga, the idea that yoga is self-study. Sva means self, and yaya means study in Sanskrit. And you conduct svadhyaya, you conduct self-study as you engage in all of these different physical practices and by studying text, by studying ancient and sacred text, whatever that ancient or sacred text is, all of those are vehicles towards self-study. Same thing, as far as I'm concerned, for Jewish ritual and practice. And I think it's either coincidence or it's not that if you think about the Hebrew word for prayer, which is tefillah, which comes from the word lehit palel, lehit palel does not mean to pray. Lehit palel is a reflexive verb that means to self-study, to self-examine, to self-assess. And what would it be like if Jews approach prayer spaces not as, this is a time when I need to bend and bow and chant in a certain manner for someone else. This is an opportunity for me to breathe, for me to sing, for me to explore poetry so that I can be self-reflective on my life, on the circumstances of the world, and on what's going on with the community members who are around me in this minyan environment.
So I connected a lot to what you were saying about needing to kind of have clarity and have real clarity of why we're doing this, why we're there. And it just struck me that it connected with this idea of, the clutter in our homes. And not to say that Judaism is clutter, but that somehow there's just too much, that what's trumpeted as one of the great virtues of Judaism, that it's this 3,000 years of accumulated treasures, is actually in some ways getting in its way, in part because maybe some of those treasures aren't working. And if we're not willing to unbundle them and get rid of the ones that aren't working, we hobble the ones that could work. And maybe also just because since so many people are not feeling connected to the totality of it, that we do somehow need to boil it down in such a way that people really could connect with it. And that just feels at odds to me with a lot of the existing Jewish movements, in particular the conservative movement and the Orthodox movement, but the conservative movement by virtue of its name, that it's all about conserving and it's all about keeping the totality of it. And I just wonder whether we have to choose one or the other. Like either we keep the totality, but it's only going to appeal to a very small number of people who can really hold the totality and get a lot out of it. Or do we have to actually make it smaller? And I think about boiling it off, like to create a reduction, so it's really, it's smaller, but it's the most powerful part of it. And I'm just wondering what your experience with yoga and how you described that, you know, makes you think about that challenge, or do you not see that as the challenge?
I think that there will be a contraction. I think that some of these movements, and to take the conservative movement as an example, for people who are really committed to it and are really immersed in it, those numbers are not going to be as big as some people might think or hope, and that's okay, because ultimately, what, speaking on behalf of myself, I want people to find meaning in Judaism, and I want them to find comfort and ease in it. And if they can find comfort and ease within the conservative movement and kind of a matbea, a set of rituals and practices and ideas that are communally agreed upon and that are brought up to date when needed, if there is a group of people that can find meaning and ease in that, wonderful. If that group is not very large, then that's the way that it needs to be. That's not really rooted in anything related to yoga, but it was an important point that I think you brought up that I wanted to validate and agree with. What I would say from drawing on some of these principles of yoga, a couple of things. One, I think we can't undervalue the importance of transitions and on quieting the mind when we create holy spaces and we create ritual experiences. What I mean by that is that it is part of the formula in a yoga practice and in a yoga sequence that you take a beat, and the beat might just be 30 seconds. Ideally, it's closer to a couple minutes or 5 minutes or sometimes even 10 minutes to just quiet down, to focus on the breath, and to perhaps focus on one philosophical idea, which is so counter to the way the world is working right now, because we are multitasking and we are trying to be everywhere and anywhere at all times. And heart, mind, and soul work, mind, body, soul work doesn't occur in that type of plane. You can't be everywhere and be doing everything. So to take a moment to quiet down so that you can enter into these sacred experiences, I think really helps you find comfort and ease once you're in them.
So, Zach, in closing, and in the interest of course, coming full circle, as we sometimes try to do, are there any ways that this discussion on yoga and mindfulness ties back into your work at the PICO Union Project?
I appreciate that. I think that one of the great things about a space like the PICO Union Project is that it is explicitly part of the mission that being in that facility and participating in the events and in the programs and experiences that occur there is a form of svadhyaya. It is a form of self-study. When I sit there and I sing, when I learn from other people, when I hear their story, I'm able and I'm given permission and encouragement to think about how that compares and contrasts to my story and my existence and my perception of the world. And I'm able to think about what are my opinions and my beliefs, and that is something that is a springboard for me to move forward in a healthy and positive manner into the world.
Craig, Jason, Zach, thanks to all three of you for coming onto this episode. It was a great conversation.
Thank you, Dana and Lex. It's been an honor to participate in the conversation that you guys are hosting, and I think it is such an important conversation, and I'm doing my best to try to rally more listeners because this is important.
Well, we're glad to hear it, and it's certainly a bonus when our guests are excited about recruiting listeners. That's fantastic. As we talk about listeners, we of course want to close up our episode by encouraging you out there, the listeners, to be in touch with us. And there are a few ways for you to do that. One is to reach out on Facebook through our Facebook page, Judaism Unbound. Another is to head to our website, judaismunbound.com. And last but not least, you can send us an email at lex@nextjewishfuture.org or dan@nextjewishfuture.org or both. And the final thing we always like to say at the close of our episodes is that we do have our Patreon page. It's a way for you to give a small monthly contribution in support of the work that we're doing at Judaism Unbound. And you can do that at www.judaismunbound.com/donate. So thanks for listening. And with that, this has been Judaism Unbound.